Coffee with Cudmore.
Light 104.7 and 1570 AM. WVTL.
Morning show continues. This particular segment was booked in the barber's chair. I go to Richard the Barber, as a lot of people know, and so does our guest, or one of our guests, David Kaczynski. And David, let me start off with a point of information before we introduce our other guest. I have been saying, honestly, from time to time, that you are with New Yorkers against the death penalty, but I see you've changed the name, or is that true, or did I always have it wrong? You've changed the name of the organization?
Yeah, and we've also changed the mission. We're now called New Yorkers for Alternatives to the Death Penalty, and since we don't have a death penalty in New York right now, we're really focused on doing whatever we can to work with communities to prevent crime and to help people who are affected by violent crime.
Sounds like interesting topics, and I hope we'll get to them. Let me turn it over to you again, David, because I've been trying to explain how our guest came to be a friend of yours. But can you tell us how you got to know Gary Wright?
Well, your listeners probably remember that back in 95, 96, there was a shadowy character out there called the Unabomber who'd been sending bombs around the country for 17 years. Three people had been killed, and one day my wife, Linda, had read an article about the Unabomber and his manifesto and said, gee, maybe, David, we should read this. Do you think it sounds a little bit like your brother? And at first I was dismissive, and then, oh, my God, once I read the manifesto, it sounded like him. And we went to the FBI, expressed our suspicions. They investigated. Ted was arrested in April 3rd, 1996, I believe. April 4th, maybe, 1996. Mm-hmm. April 3rd is actually my friend's, Gary's, birthday. You'll hear from him in a second. Sometime in the aftermath of this, as you know, we're kind of struggling with what my brother had done, how it was affecting our family, thinking about how the victims were affected. Linda and I had written some letters to victims, and ultimately I ended up making a phone call to Gary, kind of with my heart in my mouth, not knowing how he would respond, but it was really over the phone that we met.
And Gary, if you can pick up the story, you were a victim of the Unabomber.
Yeah, I was. February 20th, 1987, so coming up on another anniversary here fairly quickly. I had been working in a company that I'd founded with my family, basically my entire family, my siblings and mother and father, and drove into the parking lot one morning and saw a piece of 2x4 wood, if you will, two pieces if you, that almost looked like a 4x4 piece of wood with nails sticking out of it. Went to move it out of the driveway so that someone wouldn't run over it or step on it and injure themselves, and ultimately it exploded. A lot of damage to my face and legs and things like that with shrapnel. Typical things you'd see with a bomb, but thank God the larger pieces of them missed me. The bombs before me, there'd been a gentleman killed before me and a couple after me, so I was felt very lucky.
Huh. Now, I always thought the Unabombers had packages, but this was brought there by him, and left there, or how did that?
Yeah, there was a few that were not. There was another one at one point that was like a gasoline-type bomb early on, and this one in particular was one that had been built out of wood, and it was hollowed out, and then the bomb or explosive device was put inside, the pipe bomb was put inside with shrapnel pieces, and when it was hollowed out, it had been held together with like artificial limb cement, the things that they would hold an artificial limb together or manufacture it with a long time ago. I'm sure they're quite different now.
So the idea was to have somebody do what you did, to try to move it and then it would explode?
Yeah, there was quite a few that were kind of similar to that. The curiosity, if you will. I mean, one of the devices was actually a hollowed out book that had been sent and asked that this gentleman read it. And so, you know, you turn the pages to open it, and the hollowed out section in the middle contained the bomb. Mm. So there were a few like that.
Mm. Now, Ted Kaczynski is still alive, and now, of course, you know David Kaczynski. Why were you targeted?
Well, at that time, as near as they can tell, Ted had been down in Salt Lake City looking for temporary work. And it was kind of a strange, there was a lot lot of strange coincidences in this case, but the company that he was going to look for temporary work was actually one of my clients. I was in the computer industry at that time. And on the front of the building, the name of our company was CAMS, and it was C-A-A-M-S, and it was an acronym for the Computer and Accounting Maintenance Service. Mm-hmm. And so they're fairly sure that as he was walking by, he saw that it was a computer-oriented company, and it was picked somewhat at random. And in kind of a weird twist, about three, four blocks west of our building was an old barrel and scrap company, and that's actually where he went and bought the pipe and some of the components to build the device with.
Hmm. Now, David, why was your brother doing this? I mean, now after all these years, I'm sure this is something you've thought about a long time.
Oh, wow. If I had a short answer to that, Bob, I guess there is one short answer, and that is my brother does suffer from a serious mental illness called paranoid schizophrenia, and that involves delusional thinking. It involves feeling threatened by people who are actually not threats. And, you know, Ted, like many mentally ill people, had begun to separate himself from society and even our family. So we had once been a very, very close family, mom and dad and Ted and me. And Ted first pushed away our parents, then he kind of pushed me away. And at that point, he actually kind of pushed me out of his life when I was getting married and had invited him to come and be my best man. And part of me was upset with him for, you know, being so harsh toward our parents and toward our family. But there's another part of me that just felt, my God, he's totally alone in the world. And obviously within, you know, I don't think we're really meant to live in isolation. Some people need, you know, more interaction, more community than others, but Ted was really outside the range of what would be normal, and I think he got sicker and sicker the longer he lived in isolation out in the woods in Montana.
Now, you live in the Schenectady area now. Did you grow up around here, you and Ted and your parents?
Actually, Ted and I and my wife, Linda, all grew up in a little suburb of Chicago called Evergreen Park, Illinois. Linda and I actually met when we were 11 years old in the seventh grade. And she had gotten a job at Union College. She's been there for 33 years teaching philosophy, so I don't win too many arguments at home.
I see.
But she, you know, I was living out in West Texas, and I visited for 2 weeks 21 years ago, and I never used my return ticket. We've been happily married now for 20-plus years.
Light 104.7 FM, AM 1570. We're on the line with David Kaczynski and Gary Wright. So you called all of your brother's victims. Was that what you did, or tried to reach them all? Is that true?
Yeah, kind of how it worked is actually someone who had helped us. Linda had a childhood friend. It's funny how relationships play into this, named Susan Swanson, who was working as a private detective in Chicago, and she was a very close friend of our family. And at one point, Linda and I reached out to her feeling, you know, we needed more than the manifesto, more than suspicions to go on. So we asked her to help investigate the case. And after Ted was arrested, she helped us find addresses because she worked as a private detective for people. And for some reason, she never found Gary's address, but did find his phone number, and I believe had seen him on TV and thought, gee, he was such a nice person. He seemed so balanced in what everything he said that, you know, and she knew I was kind of in a lot of pain and thought that maybe if Gary and I talked, it might be helpful to both of us. So basically, she called Gary. Gary said, yeah, I'll talk to Dave. And she gave him my phone number, and I sat on that for, about a month. I mean, not just not knowing what I'd hear when I called. And eventually, I called Gary, and I was all prepared for what I was going to say. And then this voice comes on the line, says, now, mind you, his name is Gary Wright. Mm-hmm. The voice says, you've reached the right house at the wrong time. There's nobody home. So I kind of had to leave this
message,
you know,
aye.
Sort of quick phone message saying who I was and hoping he would, you know, I told him I'd call back later, and I did, and finally did reach him.
Mm. What was that first conversation like?
As I said, I had my heart in my mouth. I didn't know if he was going to yell at me. I was feeling kind of fragile, you know, on many levels. On one level, I was just horrified at what Ted had done. On another level, you know, I just felt, you know, like I just didn't know how to process this. I wanted to understand a little bit better what the victims had gone through. And I also wanted to apologize, find some way of saying to those folks that, you know, Ted did not reflect our family, and we're just deeply saddened and ashamed of what he'd done. And so I basically told Gary that, and, you know, his response to me was so kind. It was almost hard to believe. He said he didn't hate my brother. He said he didn't wish my brother dead. And he also told me I had nothing to apologize for, that I hadn't done any of this. I wasn't responsible. In fact, he said, gee, I hope I'd have the courage to do what you and Linda did in terms of, stopping your brother's violence.
Is that how you remember it, Gary?
Yeah, I do. I remember Dave calling, and, you could feel a little bit of, hesitation. I think you talk to enough people. I'm pretty much a social person. When you talk to enough people, you tend to be able to read people pretty quickly, and you could feel there was a little bit of tension there. And I just did best initially to, you know, put some of that to rest. I just wanted him to know that, there wasn't any animosity on my side. And the few times that I had seen him on television, I thought that he and his family had done just a wonderful job of trying to convey the feelings they had towards victims, because they always apologize. And I just wanted him to know that, hey, sometimes you need somebody who's a little bit more distant from a situation to listen to. And if you ever need to just get things off your chest as we go through the process, you can call me anytime, day, night, whatever. And I'll be there, because being objective sometimes is real tough when you're in the middle of it. That was in my case, too. Sometimes you're a little bit too close to something to be able to have any sort of objectivity.
So, and he did that? He called you back? And
yeah, over time, I mean, it might have been a month. I don't remember exactly. Dave did call back again, and there were some particularly trying times, when the case went to be prosecuted as a death penalty case because of the status of it being a terror case. If you remember, after the McVeigh case in Oklahoma City, things changed as far as the government's prosecution, and so there was a lot of pressure and confusion and things like that, a lot of raw emotion. So, yeah, we started to talk back and forth quite a bit, and it became more and more comfortable over time. And it took years to finally get to a point where I guess you would say we actually were becoming friends, because we didn't see each other a lot. We didn't even speak publicly together until 1999, other than the day after the trial, when it ended the sentencing hearing. And we appeared on Good Morning America together. But other than that, we really didn't see much of each other at all.
Mm-hmm. But I remember seeing something, a piece on TV, and maybe I'll go over to David this time. I think Gary comes up here and you go canoeing or something like that.
Yeah, that was fun. I think that was, it was People Magazine was interested in doing something, and Linda and I have a canoe, so they're saying, well, what would you want to do? And Gary and I had once gone canoeing before that up in Lake Pasico up north, and this time we went out on the Mohawk River, and they shot some things, and Gary was made all sorts of jokes.
I see.
So he really does have a way of putting people at ease, and it's been a really warm and comfortable relationship ever since. Bob, I got to tell you that the time that I really, really knew that Gary was my friend for life was on the evening of 9/11. And, of course, that was a traumatic day for our whole country, for the world, when, the planes crashed into the Twin Towers. And I remember sitting at home that evening. Linda was away in Chicago because her parents were ill. And just feeling so awful. Maybe there was an extra layer of kind of reliving this, because this was, you know, violence, terrorism on a mass scale. Mm. And at one point that evening, the phone rang, and I answered it. Gary immediately, it was Gary, and he said, "Oh, Dave, I'm so glad you're okay. I know that you take quite a few trips down to the city, and I'm really happy to hear that you're okay." And I just thought, my gosh, here's a guy almost killed by one of my brother's bombs. You know, and on a day when everybody in America is checking in with their closest friends and family members, Gary made the decision to call me.
Wow. It's 9:20 on the morning show. Our guests are David Kaczynski here in the Capital District and Gary Wright, who lives out in Northern California, I believe. They got to know, well, we've been telling this whole story. Gary Wright was almost killed, as David Kaczynski just said, by one of my brother's bombs. David Kaczynski's brother, Ted Kaczynski, the Unabomber. What is it, back to David's organization, is called New Yorkers for Alternatives to the Death Penalty. What, you had written to me, I guess I didn't put it down here in my notes, but you had said to me something to the effect that you think that your experience with Gary is something that's important to bring up now in the wake of the latest American tragedy, if you will, or shooting, involving that gets tremendous media coverage, the shootings in Tucson. How so?
One of the things when Gary and I speak publicly together and we tell our stories kind of in alternating voices, we often talk about healing and what's involved in that. And I remember Gary, during that phone conversation to me, said, Dave, you probably won't believe it now, but time does heal. Things will get better. On the other hand, you never, ever get over some things. Loss of a loved one to a homicide, a suicide of a loved one, and in our case, having a loved one who did absolutely heinous things. You live with that shadow for the rest of your life, and the question is, you can't change the past, and at some point you have to accept that. The question is, how do you go forward? And, I think the best response to violence is taking steps to prevent violence. And often our work as an organization focuses on, bringing together communities, because we all want the same things. Whatever you might feel about the death penalty or other issues, we all want less violence. And I think it really takes an entire community. The police can't do it on their own. Members of the community, members of law enforcement, mental health system, teachers, community leaders all need to work together to reduce violence. But I think it's also important in terms of responding to violence is how we respond to victims of violence. And too often they end up being forgotten. Voiceless people bring, food, probably when they're not hungry in that first week or two, and then people don't know what to say. Maybe people expect them, to move on, and it's something you never really move on with. It's something that you heal from. So part of our work has also involved, again, working with police departments and mental health people and community organizations to create a trauma response for victims of violence, so they're not left alone or alone after that first week or two when the case slips out of the news.
Now, Gary, let me direct this one to you, if I could, or the general idea. And it's been occurring to me, maybe occurring to others. I mean, what about the other victims of the Unabomber, for example? Are you in touch with them, and do they feel different? I mean, are they not as willing to talk to the family as you have been?
I think it's a variety of, I guess each one is different. Spent a bunch of time over the past 3-4 years working with three of the different victims on the sale of Ted's assets. I mean, that's been a long, drawn-out process. And the thing that I think I've found is that every single person has a unique way they go about getting through something. You have people who maybe are mentally more challenged when they're small, let's say, and they have that ability to jump up off the asphalt when they fall down and it's just a skinned knee, where another one it has a different way of hurting them.
Mm-hmm.
And some will sit for a while, but it's an internal process. And I know in my case, it was probably 6 years before I knew what I was going to do with it, because it was 9 years before I knew who had attacked me. So it was basically dealing like with a ghost, if you will. I also know that there's a very large difference between when you yourself are injured and someone who either loses someone close to them,
right,
or they see another person injured. There's quite a different process.
Sure. Because, yeah, I mean, you can speak to it yourself because it happened to you.
Right.
Yeah.
And the one, I guess the thing that finally came to be for me is the realization that if you're going to try and forgive or get on, you have to reframe it, because if you look in the dictionary, none of the words you're going to see or anything you will read will come back to you and hit close to home to say, well, I'm going to forgive this person, because those definitions don't make any sense. I don't play by that. When I redefined it, basically, it was telling myself, you care enough about yourself that you're not going to allow your friends, your family, the people around you to see yourself as less than who you are. And that means not sad. You know, you still can go on in life and have wonderful times. And that's a hard thing to do. It's simple once you do it, but getting to that point internally can take some time.
Well, Gary Wright, David Kuczynski, I thank you very much for joining us on WVTL-FM today.
Thank you.
Thank you so much, Bob.
Take care. David Kuczynski of New Yorkers for Alternatives to the Death Penalty, and Gary Wright, his friend, on the line from California. We have news coming along in just a few minutes on the morning show. Jason Aiello and Daniela Bellotta will report.